Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you all here today to this third to the last session of the roundtable for the season. We have two more weeks. Again, next week is going to be the Ivory Tower Hour. So we know that the topic is current events, so that means you have to read the newspapers. I was going to say from cover to cover or from, what do you call, page to, it's still page to page, online, whatever. All right. As far as things coming up after the end of the season, I want to give you a heads up that the Onondaga Citizens League's annual meeting will be on Friday, June 6th. Of course, you'll all be getting a save the date and an invitation for the luncheon, which will be back this year at the zoo. Yay, Janet says yay. Back at the zoo. And our guest speaker will be from the Kettering Foundation. His name is David Holwerk. And the Kettering Foundation, of which our own Fred Fisk is an affiliate, I'd guess, a scholar in residence, or not in residence, but a writer, is really all about what the Citizens League is about, promoting democracy and an educated citizenry and all of the rest. So I know that's going to be very, very, very informative and interesting. And then even more special, if it could be, will be the Levi L. Smith Civic Education Award from OCL will be presented to our own Carol Dwyer of the Maxwell School and OCL and TMR. So, big bravo. So you won't want to miss that on June 6th. So now, without further ado, thank you, Ginny Fellman. Ginny is going to introduce today's guest speaker. Thank you, Ginny.
Good morning. It is my pleasure to introduce a dear friend, Ludger Fifus Bailey, a distinguished professor of philosophy, gender, and culture at Lemoyne College. His contribution to the field of modern religious thought lies in the analysis of how discourses of religion and sexuality co-determine each other. To this end, he has integrated philosophical modes of analysis with those pertaining to gender and cultural studies. Professor Fifus Bailey received his PhD in 2001 from Harvard, and before coming to Lemoyne, was an associate professor of methods and theory in the study of religion at Yale. His work has two foci. First, the connection between sexual and epistemological practices, where he has written Beyond the Philosopher's Fear, a Cavellian reading of gender, origin, and religion in modern skepticism. Secondly, he is interested in tracing how religious, sexual, and political normativities emerge together in a modern secular nation state, a topic that led him to write a second book, Between a Man and a Woman, Why Conservative Christians Oppose Same-Sex Marriage. Currently, he is working on a book entitled No Separation, How Religion Makes a Secular Nation State. We are truly fortunate to have Ludger as a member of our community. Please join me in giving him a warm TMR welcome.
Thank you so much, Ginny. Thank you so much, Sandra, for having me. And thank you all for being here. We were talking about Berlin and Germany a little bit at our table, and as you know, I'm a weird German, you know, with that name. But I'm also old enough to still remember the wall, you know, dividing Germany, and so the engagement for democracy and the engagement for a civil society that really promotes values of liberty and equality is something, you know, biographically dear to my heart, and I'm always amazed, and I am always amazed about the level of civic engagement that American society produces, and that requires civic leaders such as I heard you all. I was last week at a dinner for service organizations that allow our students to work with them. I'm amazed by that level of civic engagement. I really want to thank you all for that. And thank you for slugging through with me through some philosophical, theoretical stuff on same-sex marriage and marriage equality. So, religious opposition and marriage equality, game over. Among all sectors of American society, we see a rising support for marriage equality. And I can give you the numbers in the Q&A if you want. Thus, is it very likely that over the long term, this marriage of same-sex couples will cease to be a topic of social conflict? Yet, as I will argue today, the core concerns of those who oppose it for religious reasons will abide politically and religiously. The debate about whether Americans of the same sex should be able to use the civil instrument of marriage are perhaps over, but the larger debate about gender equality and social hierarchies is not. Thus, the religious concerns expressed in the marriage debates can find a new home in debates about reproduction and the question of how to share justly the social responsibility and the burden of reproduction. We live in an economic situation where, in order to have a successful middle-class life, families must have two incomes, and where, in adopting the paradigm of a market society, all social interactions should be governed by individual self-interest. Thus, the following question arises: why should women curtail their individual economic interests by shouldering disproportionately the burdens of reproduction? Why should you do it? The conservative evangelical marriage theology, honed and reshaped in the battles about marriage equality, can and is already flowing into this particular socioeconomic and gendered debate. At its heart, this theology claims two theses. One, marriage, seen as a foundation of society, is not about the pursuit of self-interest, but about reproduction. Thus, the institution of marriage resists the neoliberal creed of a market society that celebrates the primacy of self-interest. Second, marriage, seen as the foundation of society, is not about equality and equal opportunity, but about submission to one's divinely ordered roles. The ordered pursuit of happiness requires complementarity and an hierarchical understanding of the sexes united in the cooperative goal to reproduce. If these points are at the heart of conservative Christian marriage theology, then they could serve as a foundational Christian critique of neoliberal capitalism. But such a critique seems politically homeless. The political bonds between evangelicals and the Republican Party will make it unlikely that a marriage theology undermining the neoliberal paradigm will gain any traction. Let me just note that 61% of all Republicans aged 18 to 29 favor marriage equality. So don't expect a conservative Christian Occupy Marriage and Wall Street anytime soon. But do expect the debates to continue about the right ordering of society and of the sexes, and the right ordering of the relationship between equality, individual rights, and social hierarchies. And do listen to the voices of conservative Christians therein, not because you or I should necessarily agree with them, but because they thematize important conflicts and contradictions in our society committed to marrying both equality and stratification of power. This conflict between equality and stratification of power resides already at the heart of the history of American ideas about marriage. Thus, I will begin today with a short overview of the history of American marriage. This will show that the supporters of marriage equality draw on one, and the opponents of marriage equality draw on another strand of this history. What motivates the opponents, however, is not the biblical text per se, but a larger theological vision of the right relationship between the sexes. Thus, we will discuss in a second step the role of the Bible in the debates about marriage equality. We will see that biblical marriages is motivated by deeper beliefs about the social and the theological orders. We will explore those beliefs in a third step, demonstrating that at stake is a vision of a society that mixes equality and social stratification. Before we begin, let me mention quickly that my research focuses on evangelical Christians, who still make up a coherent majority of those objecting marriage equality for religious reasons. Moreover, I'm not speaking as a theologian, but as a scholar of religion. I'm not equipped to discuss the truth claims that evangelical Christians make per se, but I'm interested in how they express their religious concerns and convictions, and how these concerns and convictions function in a wider political context. I do not consider all religious claims to be at heart political claims, but I'm interested in how political and theological claims interact. What do they enable, and what concerns do they transport? To study these issues, I look at a particular media and evangelizing organization called Focus on the Family. This organization still has deep reaches into the conservative Christian mainstream of the United States by influencing churches and evangelical organizations from the Southern Baptist Convention to evangelical Episcopalians. Focus's audience is particular in that it is representing the non-extremist, politically engaged, and modernizing segment of United States conservative Christians. In short, if I talk about the marriage theologies of conservative Christians, I mean those who are reached by and who see their ideals reflected by the mainstream conservative organization Focus on the Family. So first step, American marriage between romantic equality and social stratification. The debates about marriage equality profit from two sides in modern American histories of marriage. Marriage is both an institution that allows for the fulfillment of romantic equality and one that shapes a stratified society. So first, romantic equality. Historians of marriage like Harvard's Nancy Codd tell us that the ideal of romantic equality is profoundly connected to the self-understanding of the American Republic. The new republic should be based on bonds of equals, just like a marriage should be between equals who desire to be together. Hand in hand with marriage's function to build the body politic goes the ideal that marriage is based on free assent, which is fundamental and a fundamental idea in American political theology. Following Montesquieu, Christian monogamous marriage is linked to the ideal of the free republic, writes Codd. As voluntary union based on consent, marriage parallels the new government. This thinking propelled the analogy between the two forms of consensual unions in the Republican nation's self-understanding. The ideal of free union was contrasted with British colonial rhetoric likening the relationship between the crown and the subject to that between the father and his household. Thus, it's not surprising that we find during the struggle for American independence a host of pamphlets praising the state of marriage, which is seen as the emblem of free attraction and mutuality. John Witherspoon, as Codd informs us, argues that marriage is the highest case of human friendship and requires equality in education, taste, and conduct of life. This ideal of the romantic bond of marriage that is based on free assent becomes popularized over the years so much that it is experienced as a particular American institution. Memoirs of European immigrants, for example, often point to the harsh and oppressing marriage institutions in their own home countries and celebrate that America allowed them to form romantic bonds according to their own choosing. The sentiment that marriage is based on free attraction is quintessential American, and it appears as well in a sociological study by Robert and Helen Lind, Middletown, and summarizing their findings about the life of the typical American town between 1890 and 1925, they write, "The townsfolk seem to regard romance in marriage as something which must be believed in order to hold society together. Romance is essential for the perfect unity in both marriage and society." Very American idea. Romantic love, thus, is not only a widely shared cultural idea from Disney to Honeymaid commercials, it is a political idea. The freedom to choose one's life partner echoes and reinforces the freedom to bond together as a nation of equals, despite the fissures of class, race, or ethnic background. As the Alaskan judge Peter Michalski stated already in 1998, quote, "The relevant question is not whether same-sex marriage is so rooted in our tradition that it is a fundamental right, but whether the freedom to choose one's life partner is so rooted in this tradition." Judge Michalski here relies on the romantic ideal of freely chosen love. Given how central this ideal is to the formation of a middle-class subjectivity and citizenry, it is clear that the state has an interest to protect and foster this freedom of choice. Interestingly, according to the historian George Chauncey, the more the idea of equal marriage gained a hold among Americans, the more conceivably it became that we could have marriages between members of the same sex. Romantic equality, however, is only one side of American traditions of marriage. The other side is sexual stratification. This is the element emphasized by evangelical Christians. As soon as the Republic was founded, marriage was seen in terms of differences between the sexes, such that women are virtuous keepers of the household and men lawgivers in the polity. And marriage legislation turns into the battleground of who is and who is not a full citizen of these romantically united states. Marriage laws were designed to keep African Americans out of the body politic. Opponents of the women's suffrage argued that the marital bond would be threatened if women could vote, and until the 1930s, women did not have the independent claim to United States citizenship. United States legislators have traditionally guarded marriage laws as a mean to engineer desired socio-political outcomes. Thus, the historian Nancy Cott summarizes the legal debates about marriage equality in Congress, where public authorities a century earlier had been primed to defend Christian model monogamy from free love, interracial coupling, polygamy, self-divorce, and commercial sex. Now Congress found heterosexuality the crucial boundary to maintain. Evangelical Christian opposition to marriage equality indeed aims to defend the stratification of the sexes as essential for American society. But why is heterosexuality the battle line on which to defend the ideal of the respectable American marriage? Now, we could say because the Bible tells them so. And this is where we need to look at more closely how the Bible actually functions in the lives of conservative Christians. The answer the Bible tells them so, however, begs the question of why the rejection of homosexuality is a major unifying theme among Christians. In the Gospel of Mark, we find Jesus explicitly prescribing divorce, and yet we don't see Christian conservative organizations currently lobbying for an adoption ban for divorced people. Pointing to a hermeneutic of selective reading, you know, you take this text but not the other one, also does not help. This strategy rather leads to the question of why Paul's letter to the Romans, one of the texts considered proofs for the Bible's rejection of homosexual behavior, serves as a public policy statement, and the text banning divorce do not. In short, claiming that belief in biblical inerrancy is the explanation for the rejection of same-sex love makes conservative Christians seem willful and capriciously inconsistent. Thus, we have to understand that it's not the Bible that forces these beliefs, but the biblical text as a result of a particular reading. So we read the biblical text in a specific way. And indeed, if we look at conservative Christian literature, we see that they do interpret the biblical text, and they are aware that they do so. For example, the Focus advice columnist Candace Waters distinguishes in Boundless, a magazine for young people, two types of scriptural passages that require special help when interpreting them. Those are, number one, obscure texts, and those are, number two, texts that are in opposition to the current culture, like texts condemning homosexuality. She bristles at the idea of always explaining away the message of these contrarian passages with the argument that these parts of the Bible were meant for a different culture. Yet Waters acknowledges as well that sometimes such reference to historical context are important, as in the case of, for example, explaining why animal sacrifice is not required for Christians today. Thus, in the text of conservative Christian organizations like Focus on the Family, we find an awareness that reading the biblical text involves interpretation and an acknowledgement of both the scriptural and the historical context of a passage. Thus, when conservative Christians talk among themselves or to researchers about the Bible as the Word of God that is guiding their lives, then most likely a host of theological assumptions and tropes work already in the background. the anthropologist Susan Harding explored this theology of reading scripture. From her, we can learn that the Bible as divine word refers to a text whose meaning becomes alive through the agency of the Holy Spirit, or through the agency of Jesus. After all, conservative Christians know that according to Matthew, the devil resorts to quoting scripture when he tries to tempt Jesus, and preachers and anyone else who wishes to discern the true meaning of the biblical text thus need to speak in such a way that the Spirit can work. So reading is not easy theologically. But how can we as individuals be sure that her fellow Christians is speaking with the right authority, that is, with the Spirit? The hallmark of such an interpretation is the assurance that the Spirit works in the heart of the congregation. In other words, it is for the Spirit-filled community to judge whether or not they feel that the preacher is authentically bringing the Word of God to life. These resonances between the Spirit-filled community and the Spirit-filled preacher, who in turn aims to allow the biblical word to work within the audience, are important to note. Biblical inerrancy as an interpretive strategy therefore presupposes a circuit of relationships between individual readers of the Bible who consider themselves filled with the Spirit, their communities, and their preachers. The Bible may be seen as the unquestionable authority to guide one's life, yet knowing whether or not a specific preacher or fellow Christian speaks with biblical authority depends on whether these words resonate as true and as Spirit-filled within the community. What resonates as true within a given community may not always be clear, and there are conflicts, and it can change rather quickly. Thus, the members of a single church can and do subscribe to various interpretations of a biblical passage, and importantly, such interpretations can become forgotten, fall away, even those that were at one point promoted vigorously by church officials. For example, as American historian Jane Daly writes, there once was a broad consensus among Southern white evangelical Christians that segregation was biblically founded and thus divinely mandated. Quote, Dr. W. M. Caskey, a professor of Mississippi College, the state's leading Baptist institution, explained in 1960, "We believe that this Bible teaches that thou wast the original segregationist." For many conservative Christians, the conviction that God was a segregationist was grounded in what they perceived as the correct reading of the biblical text. It was plain and simple for them that interracial marriage was the sin that God punished in Sodom, and that the flood or the destruction of the Tower of Babel. That segregation rests on the biblically warranted divine order for each race to inhabit its divinely allotted territory was an ideal of wide appeal. As this appeal waned and social support for segregation eroded during the late 1960s and 1970s, so did the circuits of resonance that saw this policy grounded in the Bible. There was no debate about the very verses that allegedly showed that God was a segregationist. Rather, as Harding observes, these verses simply stopped to be cited. So there was no exegetical struggle. They stoutly felt by the wayside. They, or rather their prevailing interpretation, which had been considered to be biblically inerrant truth, ceased to be part of the spoken Bible. In sum, what is at stake for Christians is not the text understood as a string of letters, but as the biblical word, which is conceived of as an authoritative because it resonates as true within the Spirit-filled believers. The question then is, what establishes these resonances? And here my argument is that a wider theological and political concern about the sexual order of society establishes the particular understanding of the spoken Bible that leads conservative Christians to oppose same-sex marriage. So a wider theological and political ideal guides the reading of the text that then establishes the resonances of plausibility. So what theological stratification of sexuality is at stake? To see this point, let us examine some resources that Focus on the Family offers to help Christians to reflect on the issues of marriage equality. Here we read, for example, quote, "Reproduction is a central, even if not obligatory, part of the social significance of marriage. let me note the curious choice of words in this formulation, calling reproduction as an essential and obligatory feature of marriage would establish an interest in letting only those couples marry who are, in fact, able or most likely to reproduce. Focus on the family doesn't go that far. Yet, yes, childless marriages are of less interest to the state, yet to tie marriage too closely to procreation would force the state to intrude too deeply into the heterosexual couple's privacy. If reproduction is not essential for evangelicals and society's definition of marriage, and if we consider the marriage of infertile couples to be valid, why not acknowledge loving and caring relationships of same-sex couples? Focus answers that these couples are incapable of the correct, quote, type of sexual act that results in natural reproduction. An infertile heterosexual couple can still be married because the right sexual pairing of one man and one woman is present in this relationship, which enables them to engage in the right type of sex. In other words, the essence of marriage consists in the presence of the right pairing of genitals, the presence of one penis and one vagina. Well, I want to say this is a, you may laugh, but I want to say this is a, this is actually, you know, this is actually theologically important and meaningful, and I will show you how. While it seems as if the importance of biological reproduction grounds this focus on heterosexual complementarity, other texts in Focus on the Family Universe de-emphasize curiously the importance of fertile sex. Brio, Focus's former publication for teenage girls, tells its readers that despite that what may they may hear around them, they intuitively know that marriage is a special and holy union between a man and a woman. As such, it is not a private matter, but has important social task to fulfill. So this is a very important insight of conservative Christians, that marriage is not a private matter, but what we do in this most intimate relationship is something that is connected to the shaping of the state. Remember American romance, right? It's the same idea. So if that's true, then how we perform our marital acts is of social importance and is of theological importance. Hence, it's not a laughing matter per se. So marriage helps us not only to understand sexual relationships, moreover, it unites in mutuality the two parts of humanity and delivers mothers and fathers to children. Procreation is curiously absent in these arguments. The authors of the Brio article only use this odd formulation that marriage delivers fathers and mothers to children. Likewise, the Bible verses quoted in other magazines like Breakaway do not mention procreation but focus again on gender complementarity. In fact, they stop short of citing the very passages in Genesis that talk about procreation. Thus, Focus's talking points on marriage read, marriage is the only means for melding the two sexes into a stronger and more complete whole. Gender distinctions are not merely a social construct. Men and women are uniquely designed to complement each other physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So that's the unitive function. How important this unitive function is for Focus on the Family shows a quick view to its marital advice literature. Since marriage's task is the melding of the two sexes together, it is unsurprising that Focus declares sexual fulfillment for couples, orgasm for both husband and wife, to be the goal of marital heterosexual acts. Each sex act, therefore, should aspire to the unitive function in this particular sense. We can see that in a discussion about whether or not to use a vibrator in helping a wife to become orgasmic. And here, Focus on the Family presents advice of sex advice therapist Dr. Clifford and Jenny Penner, who write, sex was designed for becoming one, as instructed in Genesis 2:24 and referred to again in 1 Corinthians 6:16 and Ephesians 5:31. Because the vibrator can interfere with your ability to learn to respond to his touch, we do not recommend the vibrator as a way to learn to be orgasmic. The unitive function of the marital act, the task of bringing the two sides of humanity together, governs the morality of each sexual act. That's something familiar to Roman Catholic sexual theologies as well. And again, the insight is what we do with our sexed bodies is of political importance. So the organization of our sexual lives is of political importance and of theological importance. So the vibrator is problematic not because there's no reproduction or fertility involved, but it may hinder the full union of the couple. The goal of becoming one in marriage is achieved by orgasmic mutuality through mutual stimulation of one real penis and one real vagina. So sexual complementarity is at the heart of Christian marriage. What is at stake here? Why is that important? It's important for conservative Christians like those reached by Focus on the Family that the complementarity of the sexes implies itself a hierarchical ordering of the sexes. After all, an important piece of conservative evangelical marriage theology is the understanding that the husband is the head of the household, and he is responsible for the spiritual well-being of the family and the last source of authority. The complementary attitude of the wife is submission. So we have the idea of complementarity. At the same time, we also have a stratification of submission and headship. In conservative Christian lead texts about the proper biblical understanding of submission, ideals of equality are mixed with those of sexual hierarchies and masculine authority. And it's important to note that this is true even for texts from a single organization such as Focus. For example, Kimberly Ray, a Christian missionary, writes, explaining why the Bible states the husband should be the head of the household. She uses the metaphor of the team to declare that the husband has to make the final decision in the matters of the family. Without a leader, a team will be unproductive because individual team members will either be inactive or act without coordination with one another. Quote, a family is a team, and in any team, somebody has to be responsible for the final decision. The wife as a team player, or executive vice president, or second in command, these are tropes that are used to explain biblical submission. Although this does not imply that the wife has no authority, she has to obey her husband's wishes, or the entire family will fall apart. Thus, Ray's text echoes the familiar Christian manuals from the 1970s that stated that once the husband has made a decision, the team has to work together to implement it. Quote, in this relationship, they share a oneness, a good communication, emotional peace and security, provided the vice president is not struggling to gain control. Through these analogies, the marital relationship is clearly hierarchized. And I want to point to you, there's a link between theological language and at the same time also political language, right, the vice president. So it's important to note, however, that biblical submission is difficult terrain. And we find here the opposing values of evangelical marriage theology. More mainstream organizations like Focus aim to balance the submissive stratification of power with a claim that we are also created equal. So we're both created equally, remember romance, but at the same time we are created as stratified. So this struggle between the right ordering of the sexes that we find in Focus on the Family texts reflects the struggle of American marriage theology. Equality, romantic equality, and stratification. So they are quintessentially American in their theology of sexuality. Since the sexual order in marriage organizes the largest social order, we can see that at stake in conservative Christian religious resistance to marriage equality is an investment in a stratified hierarchical society. At the same time, conservative Christian groups like Focus on the Family also express the values of some form of equality between the sexes. Thus, their sexual political theology expresses, to my mind, clearly the conundrum of equality and dominance characterizing modern democratic governance. On the one hand, we are all supposedly equal. United we stand, right? On the other hand, we clearly see structures of political domination in terms of race, class, and yes, sexuality. This is our reality. What Focus on the Family presents to us as a theology is, in fact, a reflection of our political reality. Social and political power is not equally accessible to all. In this sense, the insistence of conservative Christians that social life should not be completely equalized may reflect reality. and may provide a theological political framework for the normativity of the factual. Importantly, however, this investment in social hierarchies is profoundly theological. As one Southern Baptist woman states in conversation with the sociologist Sally Gallagher, "I think there's a lack of respect for God because we have lost the idea of a husband's authority. They say you usually relate to God through the image of your father presents of him. And if there's no father there, then how are you going to see what he is really like? And how are you going to look to God with respect of authority?" So see again the link between political, familial, and theological tropes. In this woman's words, specific ideas about her husband's authority or that of the father and about the power of God are interconnected and can mutually illuminate each other. Whither then the resistance to same-sex marriage? So what is the future of these sexual political concerns, sexual theological political concerns that are currently expressed in religious opposition to same-sex marriage? First, I assume that given the growing trend leading a majority of Americans to accept these marriages, the biblical texts that are currently used to express religious discontent will simply lose their urgency. They will fall away or will be interpreted differently. Second, I assume that the wider theological and political concerns of balancing sexual equality and hierarchy will remain. They are profoundly American. We haven't figured it out. Thirdly, at the heart of this balance lies the problem of reproduction. Right? Reproduction is at the center of marriage, and at the same time it's not, so reproduction seems to be a problem. This brings us back to the beginning of this talk. What does it mean to share the burdens and responsibilities of the bearing and raising of children in a neoliberal capitalist society, a society that is so deeply influenced by the paradigm of the market and the pursuit of individual happiness and profit? Thus, the next frontier of religious political conflicts will be the debates focusing on how to distribute socially the responsibilities and burden of reproduction. Stay tuned. Conservative Christians will have something to say about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Sure. You raise all sorts of interesting questions, and I'm sure we'll have some. And I think this is typical of one of those talks where, at least for me, I didn't even know what I didn't know. So here we go.
I inferred from your remarks that the definition of marriage is in flux, not so much on the religious side, but to some extent, but on the civil side, certainly. And do you envision a continuation, perhaps, to polygamous society, or perish the thought, an incestuous marriage from a civil point of view?
The short answer is no. And why I say that is, I talked about the particular American history of marriage. Right. So there's a particular American ideology about marriage that we work on for the last couple of hundred years. So polygamous marriages are, you find them in the Old Testament, right? We find them in America in conversations with the Mormon Church. But at the heart of the American ideal of romance is this binding of two. And as long as we don't find a huge cultural investment in having Disney movies, etc., finding bonds of multiples, we will not see that. So the idea of romance is so ingrained in American ideas of marriage and so profoundly part of our political imagination, and romance is so profoundly focused on the finding fulfillment on one body, one total fulfillment on one body, that I don't think we will see that. I don't think that we'll see that. Parrish, the thought about ancestral relationships, again, that would it would not work with the script of romance that we currently have, you know, despite, that would not work. So, marriage was traditionally used by American legislators to engineer the body politic, right? We have to see that historically, American legislators have always used marriage as a tool for social engineering and to keep certain people out, right? So, yes, that's true. In that sense, civil marriage in America has always been in flux, but I don't think that we have the political grounds for this scenario.
Technical difficulties here. Oh, okay. So I have a question to fill in as I walk across the room. If, as I understand it, if the Christian right or evangelicals or focus on the family makes the tie between marriage and procreation, that's the ultimate purpose of marriage.
They don't quite make the tie.
That's
the funny thing. They do not quite make that tie. That is a Roman Catholic idea that each sex act has to be open towards the possibility of procreation. Each sex act, order to be moral. Hence, the rejection of homosexuality is in line with the rejection of all other forms of sex acts who are not open to procreation. Okay. Conservative Christians, in the text that I look at, gesture towards procreation, but ultimately do not use that argument, but say what is ultimately at stake is the presence of the right sexual pairing.
Okay, so that's different.
So
my question was going to be
difference.
About the views on, and you're right, I'm probably looking at the Roman Catholic view of it, what then are the feelings about either pairing of people outside of civil or religious marriage and or the birth control question among the Christian right?
Well, birth control is not an issue for conservative Christians, but sex outside of marriage is clearly not moral. So sex is only moral if it happens within marriage, according to conservative Christians. But marital sex is moral because it has the right pairing of genitals.
Accompanying the increasing tolerance for same-sex and marriage equality in America is the seeming persistence or the widespread intolerance not only for marriage equality but for homosexuality in places in African nations, for example, maybe elsewhere also. And I'm just stunned to read the stories about polls that show 98% of Nigerians polled think people practicing homosexuals should be severely punished just for being or practicing. Do you see that? I mean, first, do you acknowledge that? And secondly, do you see that as some kind of a colonial missionary legacy that the imperialism has left, conferred on Africa? And is it some kind of a distortion of these features of romance and stratification and politics that you discussed as it applies to America?
I mean, yes, I clearly see that. And it's a very vexing topic, and I think all the elements that you mentioned, the colonial history, the continued imperial dominance of the Western American framework is part of that. I think it's very, very hard to analyze. For me, it's very hard to analyze right now to see how this really works on the ground. We have to remember that American evangelical Christian organizers went to Uganda and helped with the formulation of these laws. So there are multiple strains of agency going on, but it's a very complex topic for which I currently have no analytic frame. No.
Yeah, if you go back a couple of generations, all of the Americans came from someplace else in the world. To what do you attribute this unique American thinking to?
I think it's this idea of equality, right? The idea that America is founded allegedly as a nation of equals, and that the democratic bound allegedly is a bound of equals. So the link here is the ideal that we can come together only on the power of our will, of our will to join together. And that was seen the marriage bond was seen as reflecting the bond of democracy. So.
As I listened to the discussion or the discourse this morning, my mind went a little bit wider, and it went into the area of employment as it related to the father figure and the wife figure. Does the same line of reasoning that you have found in your research that pertains to marriage also pertains to employment, where the women should be looking to a supervisor to be male?
That's a very very interesting question. Conservative Christians have for a long time objected to the idea that women should be working outside of the home. However, the group that I'm looking at, Focus on the Family, is part of a very mobile and modern group of Americans. And they realize that it's not feasible to maintain that women should not work outside of the home. And there they make the distinction, outside of the home, women can engage in all sorts of capitalist practices and become leaders, but in the home they should not.
I'm intrigued. I'm going to ask a follow-up to this gentleman's question. Maybe it's just a comment. It has to do with this question of equality and the environment that America created with respect to man and woman, as you suggest, seem limited to white people. And I wonder if you might want to comment on that, because at the same time, the African slave was not regarded as human, the Native American was not regarded as human. Why the contradiction?
Yes, that's what I wanted to point out in my two-sidedness, right? I was talking about the two sides of American democracy and theories of marriage. The one side is this ideology of equality. We're all the same. But the other side is we're not the same. And that is part of American political reality. And here, marriage is the tool of social engineering, right? So everybody who says, oh, traditional marriage was always the same thing, no. American marriage was always the tool of social engineering to keep people out. So legislators have, as long as we have America, used to control marriage to keep people out. And that is the inherent contradiction of a democratic system, right? That allegedly we are all the same, united we stand, but in reality we are not. And we have a whole host of means of cultural and political tools to make sure that equality gets resorted into inequality. And we can see that very clearly at the marriage legislation. So this inherent contradiction would be, here I have the frame of analysis, but that would be ultimately an analysis of capitalism and the intersection between capitalism and democracy.
Although I fully support gay men and women marrying and having all the rights granted to them, as a Roman Catholic, the difficulty I have is in the sacrament of marriage. And I'm just wondering about terminology or what all that means.
Yes. And you are with many Roman Catholics there. So Roman Catholic teaching is very, very clear, right? Roman Catholic teaching is very, very clear that only sexual acts that are open to procreation can be moral acts. And the ideal is to have that reflected also in civil society. If we have to make compromises, then we have to make sure to not confuse, right? Now, in many European countries, you have the clear separation between marriage as a civil instrument from marriage as a religious instrument. So you cannot contract a religious marriage and have that automatically be valid civically, right? In Europe, in Germany, there's a very strict separation between what you can do in a church, and what you do in a church has no bearing on what you do in front of the state. So they use the same word, marriage, but it is institutionally clearly separate. In America, we have this weird thing that what you do in front of a religious minister has civil consequences, which is an odd organization. So I think the German legal framework would keep these things more separate.
This is sort of a check. I'm hearing you say that the political, economic, culture, or society leads and religious institutions follow. It's to the opposite. Religious institutions do not lead. Am I hearing you correctly?
I think that is not quite. That's difficult to say in the United States context, because the transformations of political theological plausibilities in the United States have always been pushed by religious leaders as well. So it's not the case that all religious people oppose same-sex marriage, and therefore somehow non-religious civil society has to pick up the slack. So I wouldn't want to say that it's always the case that religion follows the civic, but it's conflicted civic leaders such as you all, who have conflicting and multiple ideas and allegiances, who change frameworks of plausibilities that then seep back into the understanding of how religious people see their own realities.
We all know that beyond a certain age, women do not conceive. Does that mean any sexual act that I had with a woman who could no longer conceive was immoral? I'm 88 years old. I've been married for 65 years. Are you telling me I've been acting immorally for all that period of time?
Well, it's here maybe conservative Christians can be a solace, right? For them, it is not, as again, it's very important to understand that for conservative Christians, in the context of focus on the family, it is not reproduction which makes sexual acts moral. For them, it's the pairing of the right complementary sexual organs. So for conservative Christians, there's a different understanding of the sexual act, where and that I find so intriguing, because ultimately that says that it is the gender complementarity, which in turn is gender stratification, which is at stake.
So as long as his wife remains subject to him, it's okay.
Yeah.
I don't think she'll like to hear that. All right.
And as long as he submits to the right kind of headship, right? I mean, the submission and headship is a very complicated terrain, as complicated as American democracy, right, where we are all the equals, but we are not.
I'm hearing loud and clear the stratification. I'm not hearing anything really about equality. The only place I heard about equality is that a man and a woman have the right to come together, and only a man and woman to come together. So they're equal in that. But if you're really equal in equality in terms of coming together, then why can't two men come together, and why can't two women come together? If that's the only place I'm hearing equality.
Yeah, that's why the historian George Sonsi says the more Americans got familiar with the idea that men and women have equality, right? Let's not recall that this is not so. That this, you know, let's not forget that this is not a, that this is a recent thing, right? The more the Americans warmed up to the idea that men and women are actually equal in marriage, the more they became open for same-sex marriage. Another element for that openness is also knowing somebody who is actually gay or lesbian. A stunningly larger population of Americans now say they know many people who are gay and lesbian, or they know a gay or lesbian person in their families. So as that knowledge increases, it's going to be really hard to say, well, but I don't want you to have the same civil opportunities that I have.
I was curious as to why we don't seem to have a consensus on this across the country. Why is there such a difference between sections of the country, the United States?
Well, I think part of that has to do with the political organization of the United States, right? Who politically jumps on that bandwagon and who doesn't, who uses this as a political tool and who doesn't. But I think if we were to look more into, for example, our rural communities, we would find a different picture than if we look at communities in cities. So part of that, I think, has to do with the American electorate and how it's organized and divided and the options it has. Another part has to do with the kind of Christianity that is prevalent in different sections of the country.
So you mentioned during your remarks that there were some statistics. Are there some numbers that would, you know, kind of illustrate the how many, when we're talking about the evangelical or Christian right, what percentage of the population is that? And, you know, how does that reflect on democracy and majority rule?
Well, it's roughly a quarter, but again, it's a substantial part of the population. But again, we have to distinguish between white evangelicals and African American evangelicals. 71% of Catholics currently support same-sex marriage. So that's a stunning number. 79% of mainline Protestants support same-sex marriage. 79% of mainline Protestants will think that actually same-sex marriage is inevitable. As I said, 61% of all Republicans age 18 to 29 support marriage equality. So we have a population in flux, right?
Yes, I'd be interested to know how you feel the feminist movement has influenced these changes, what it has done to the basic thinking that has evolved.
Well, if we take up on the idea that as more Americans think that the sexes are created equal, and as more Americans think that in their marriages there should be equality between the sexes, as more Americans think that, they're more amenable put to the idea of same-sex marriage. So without the feminist movement, we would not be at this juncture at all. So, and that, I think ultimately, that's what I wanted to say, ultimately it's about the relationship between men and women and that power stratification, right? That's the issue. So I think we're at the heartland of feminist issues. So.
Thank you, Professor Vuce-Bailey, for stimulating our thinking this morning.